Last Thursday, Governor John Kasich signed Senate Bill 5, legislation which dramatically limits the collective bargaining rights for 360,000 public employees in Ohio. The bill mandates state workers pay 15% of their health insurance premiums. It bars public workers from striking. It eliminates binding arbitration, and it bans unions from requiring so-called fair share payments from non-union members. The bill signing marks only the start of what will be a long and expensive battle. Democrats and unions vow to collect the 250,000 signatures necessary to put the issue on a state referendum in November.
They'll be out there working night and day to get it, to make it happen. I don't think they realize what they've done, because when you start playing with people's means to support their families, it really wakes them up, even the ones that didn't vote the last time.
Joining all sides to fill on the details of Senate Bill 5 and tell us what to expect next is Dayton Daily News State House reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
Laura, let's start with the changes that were made in Senate Bill 5 before it passed the House. What was the biggest change that that the House did?
Well, probably one of the most contentious things, probably one that they were able to make that got a bunch of Republicans on board, was the amendment to allow unions to bargain for safety equipment, although it doesn't really define what that is. This is something that the police and firefighters really wanted. They also wanted but didn't get the ability to bargain for staffing levels, like being able to have a say in the minimum number of firefighters on a big fire truck or minimum number of officers in a cruiser in a high-crime area. Another big change was that they set up a referendum system so that if a city council or a school board or college trustees pick, you know, the more costly agreement option, and it turns out it will cost it'll require more taxes to pay for it, then the voters can petition to have a referendum on that. They saw that as sort of a compromise, you know, a way of having a resolving impasse. State Senator Bill Seitz says, though, that now there are three ways for labor to lose. Because the first way, the council doesn't vote, and the management offer then takes effect, or the council picks management's offer, or the council picks the higher offer, and then the voters have a chance to say no.
292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. We're talking about what's next for collective bargaining, the overhaul that was approved by the House and signed into law by John Kasich last week, although the law doesn't take effect for 90 days and likely won't until at least November. The safety equipment concession, was that enough to it wasn't enough, I assume, to satisfy opponents to this bill?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think that, you know, the Democrats held on to their strategy, which pleased the unions, which was kill the bill. Don't acquiesce to a single change to improve it. And so this is an entirely a Republican bill, and I think that the Democrats wanted to kind of stick to that strategy in both the House and the Senate.
One of the things that came up sort of late in the debate on the House side were these things called fair share dues. These are the dues that, say, you're a state employee who works in an area that is represented by a union, but you don't join the union, yet you gain all of the benefits that the union has, the higher pay perhaps, the health insurance benefits, the vacation time, the working conditions, everything else. If you are not a member but taking advantage of those benefits, right now you pay a fair share due that comes out of your paycheck automatically. This bill would do away with that.
That's correct, and this is something that the Democrats say is just all about consolidating Republican power, and this is not going to save a dime of money in the budget crisis that state and local governments are facing. And the thing is with these fair share fees is that they're agreed to by both sides, both the employer and the labor. They work that out in their labor agreements. And the other thing is that the unions will still have to represent fair share members in grievances or labor disputes or what have you.
It seems like it puts employees now. So employees under this bill would have to voluntarily make this payment, and that obviously cuts into the bottom line for the unions and their ability to raise money and then of course support Democrat candidates.
If they're gonna voluntarily make a fair share payment, then they're gonna voluntarily they're gonna stick with their union dues. You know, many workers I think will opt not to pay either. They'll see this as a raise. Maybe they take some hits on their step increases, their longevity pay, their health care expenses. So they might say, well, I'm not I'm not joining the union. I'm not going to pay my dues. I'm not going to pay these fees. And they'll still get the benefits. And I think it's really going to thin the ranks of the unions across the state.
We're talking Senate Bill 5, the collective bargaining overhaul, signed into law by John Kasich last week. Laura Bischoff is our guest, the State House reporter with the Dayton Daily News. Laura, does it set up the cities and towns? One more question on this fair share. So cities and towns, if you don't agree to join the union or pay a fair share due, then the city or town could then wouldn't extend the benefits, whether it be pay or step increases, like you mentioned, to those employees. But in reality, aren't the cities and towns going to, from administrative purposes and just to make it easier and more cost-effective on their point, just to give everybody who's doing, say, trash collection the same wages and benefits?
It's my understanding that if your position is covered by that bargaining unit, whether you pay a fair share fee or not, you're going to get the same pay.
Yeah. So in theory, you could separate non-union from union, but it's not going to happen in practice.
No, I don't think so.
No. 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion about Senate Bill 5, if you have a question for Laura Bischoff about what's next in this fight. Laura, what is next?
Well, the timetable is the next 90 days. The first step is that the unions, the anti-Senate Bill 5 side, needs to get 1,000 signatures initially and then take it to the Attorney General and the Secretary of State's office and get their petition language certified to say that it's an accurate representation of what they're trying to do. And then they need to go out and start collecting 231,147 valid signatures mm-hmm. from Ohio voters. And they have to have them distributed across the 88 counties. There's a formula of what's required. And I think it's going to – and they're going to have to start raising money, too, because this is going to be a very expensive campaign. Somebody told me that they thought it would cost as much as the governor's election.
Which was around $30
million. $30
million,
right.
Wow.
And I think it's going to – I would not be surprised to see that happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a lot of money from outside groups and also within the state of Ohio. And it's going to be this epic battle between unions and business.
Because the Wisconsin, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think Wisconsin faces, some of the state reps and state senators up there face recalls, but the Wisconsin bill is not going before the voters. Am I wrong on that?
That's my understanding as well. They're focused more on picking off the ones who voted in favor of it.
Mm-hmm. So this will be a real watershed nationally on this fight over collective bargaining overhauls, and you can see the national money coming in.
Exactly. And, what's interesting on the timing is that I think the Republicans wanted to force this on they knew a referendum was going to happen. They wanted to force it to happen in 2011 rather than 2012 when President Obama is up for re-election. Of course, he just announces his re-election bid yesterday.
Yes. But also, certainly all of the House members in the Ohio House would have been up for re-election in 2012 as well, and some of the Senate members as well. I'm guessing they didn't want to be on the ballot at the same time that this union fight was on the ballot as well.
Oh, that's exactly right. I think they're very concerned about how this is going to play out in their own re-election, and they're hoping maybe the voters might forget about it by 2012.
Mm-hmm. 292-8513, if you have a question about Senate Bill 5, what's next in the fight over collective bargaining in Ohio? 231,000, roughly, signatures. If there's 360,000 union members in the state, getting 500,000 signatures as a cushion is not going to be hard.
No, I don't expect that they'll have any trouble getting their required signatures.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be more interesting to see how much money they can raise to counteract the pro Senate Bill 5 side. And both sides say that they expect to be outspent. I think that the thing that the unions have going for them is that they do have a lot of foot soldiers. They have a lot of people that are really rallied up about this. And these are folks who are, our friends and neighbors. These are the teachers down the street, the police officers, the firefighters, the nurses, prison guards. They're our friends and neighbors. So I think that they're going to have that going for them.
When you think of off-year elections, now this is a special case, but generally off-year elections is certainly odd number year off-year elections. The turnout tends to be lower, and in those elections, the benefit goes to the groups that can organize and get their vote out because they will make up, thus, the majority of the folks casting ballots. Will that hold true so the unions have a grassroots advantage in this campaign that's coming up?
I almost think that it does favor them rather than going in 2012. I mean, 2012, it would favor Obama, but I think that the unions are probably in a little bit better shape because of that, because it's sort of like a special election. I mean, it is a statewide election, and it'll have a big draw, but it's nothing compared to a presidential or a gubernatorial year.
Mm-hmm. We're talking Senate Bill 5 with Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. What is the ballot language going to look like? Are you going to have to vote no to say yes to the unions, or...
No, I think that the unions will get the no side. It will be a shall this law take effect, yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
And the unions want to say no.
So,
and actually, usually on a referendum or an issue, people want to have the no side, because if voters are at all concerned or fuzzy on it, they tend to vote no.
But as you mentioned, if they're spending $30 million, the chances are that the voters are going to know what a yes or a no vote means by the time November comes around.
Wait, oh, sure. But I also think that the campaign is going to be very rich with examples of public employees, in that I think the pro-SB5 folks will show public employees cashing in, a year's worth of unused vacation and then hitting the golf links in luxury while the rest of hardworking Americans scrape by.
Uh-huh.
And I think the union folks will use images of heroic police and firefighters saving people, empathetic teachers, working with small children, caring nurses. And they'll talk a lot about labor history and rights, and put it sort of in the context of this is what America is about.
I'm guessing the term Wall Street may come up at some point during this campaign.
It usually does.
John Kasich has played more of a supporting role, it has been here in Ohio, as opposed to Scott Walker in the governor of Wisconsin, which has led the fight for collective bargaining overhaul there. John Kasich sort of followed the lead of the Senate here. It's Senate Bill 5. Do you expect him to play a more prominent role in this campaign?
Oh, sure. I think he will. He's already, he came out early supporting it. But I think you are right in that the Senate, State Senator Shannon Jones, a Republican from Springboro, she kind of jumped out early on this. I think that Kasich might have been planning his own, package of reforms, and but the Senate, kind of got the jump on it before his administration did.
Mm-hmm. But he won't. He'll still be. I mean, Democrats are going to put this as a referendum on John Kasich.
Oh, yeah. They're going to pin it to him like a boutonniere.
Mm-hmm. And we'll see how it turns out. The polls have shown that, Ohio, the latest Quinnipiac poll, showed that it was a difference between how the ballot language was worded. If it contained the word rights of collective bargaining, it won by or was leading by like 10 points or 8 points. And then if it was just collective bargaining, it was down closer to 5. But the polls have shown nationally and here in Ohio that people generally oppose limits on collective bargaining.
Right. And I think that's why the unions will use the word rights, and they'll talk about labor history, and they'll, you heard a lot of stuff on the House floor about the Triangle shirtwaist factory fire.
Yep.
Which was, we just had the 100-year anniversary. There's 146 people that died in that fire, and there was that was sort of spurred a lot of the labor movement in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they'll talk about these horrible conditions from years ago.
Okay, thanks, Laura Bischoff, State House reporter from the Dayton Daily News.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
We'll be talking about this, I'm sure, once or twice between now and November.
Yeah, I think so too.
Thanks very much. When All Sides continues, we'll talk about a battle of a different sort, one that occurred 150 years ago. We'll look back at the Civil War as we celebrate or observe the 150th anniversary. When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Connect Ohio wants to get every citizen online. With high-speed internet service, you can do more than you ever imagined. With free classes, it's easy. You can search for a new job and apply from home, take classes online, or visit with your family face-to-face at any time you want. Get connected. Free internet training classes are forming at your local library or community college. To enroll, call 1-855-NOW-I-CAN. That's 1-855-NOW-I-CAN. And find out what you can do with broadband.
This is 89.7 NPR News. It's 68 degrees in downtown Columbus, with showers and thunderstorms coming through the area at this hour. A wind advisory is in effect with wind gusts of up to 55 miles per hour. There's also a chance of penny-sized hail through 10:45 this morning. Showers and thunderstorms are likely throughout the rest of the afternoon and into tonight, a low of 37 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 49. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War. It was a war that turned brother against brother and left no family untouched. The casualty statistics are staggering. More Americans died in battle or because of disease during the Civil War than all other American wars combined. While the Civil War destroyed slavery, the racism of that period intensified in the years that followed. It took another century to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which outlawed racial discrimination and segregation. In fact, the 100th anniversary of the Civil War in 1961 was a whites-only celebration. Today we'll talk with two Civil War historians about the true history of the four-year Civil War. We'll hear how military strategy evolved during that war and the role African Americans played in the war. And we'll take a look at the leadership styles of U.S. President Abraham Lincoln with Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Our guests, two experts on the Civil War. John Marzalek, he is a professor emeritus of history at Mississippi State University. He is the author and editor of 13 books and is best known for his award-winning book, Sherman, A Soldier's Passion for Order. Welcome, John, to All Sides.
Well, thank you, Mike. Good to be with you.
Also joining us, Craig Simons, professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy. He's the author of 12 books and the editor of 9 others. His latest is The New York Times Complete Civil War, 1861 to 1865. Welcome, Craig.
Good morning, Mike, and good morning to you, John.
Yeah, Craig. Good to hear your voice.
All right, John and Craig will be featured speakers for the Sherman House Museum Civil War Symposium in Lancaster coming up April 15th through the 17th, and we'll hear more about that program in the symposium later on in the show. If you have a question about the Civil War, an observation about the Civil War's legacy, how it should be remembered here 150 years later, give us a call at 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. John, we'll start with you. How should we mark this 150th anniversary?
Well, I think my own view of it is, and I think most historians and most people interested in the war would agree with this, that we need to make it as inclusive as we possibly can. You made a very good point at the beginning that the centennial celebration was a whites-only celebration. And in fact, it was insulting in a number of ways to black people. And I think what we've learned since that centennial, the 50 years since, is that blacks played a major role in the war. They ought to be included on a complete, full basis. And I would argue, too, that African Americans themselves need to take a stand on this. In other words, need to participate. When something's going on, say, in Ohio, for example, on the Civil War, we need to have African Americans involved as well as everybody else.
Craig Simons from the U.S. Naval Academy, expert on the Civil War. How should the way the Northern states observe this anniversary and Southern states observe this anniversary, should it be different?
Well, Mike, I have to begin by saying that I noticed when you were introducing the topic that you first said we're going to have a celebration of
the 150th
anniversary and then change that to a recognition. I think that's a key difference. There has been a tendency in the post-Civil War era to begin celebrating the great heroes, the great battles, the self-sacrifice, and so forth. We need to remember the tragic element of the Civil War as well. The Civil War was the greatest traumatic experience in American history. It changed America as much or more than any other experience in our national history. And we need to remember not only the battles and the leaders, but also the trauma and the sadness. So as far as the differences between the sections, northern states versus southern states, I'll tell one quick story here, if I may. I was in the South talking about William T. Sherman, in fact, John. This is poaching on your territory
yes.
a little bit. But someone mentioned, well, that Sherman, he was a terrible man. He just came through here and he burned everything that was in sight. And I said, well, you know, and I began to have a conversation with him. And he said, well, here's what I want to know. What do the people up north say when they sit around at night and talk about William T. Sherman? And I said, well, you know what? Northerners don't sit around and talk about William T. Sherman. So the impact of that legacy affected southern states and northern states differently. And there is a tendency to remember the war slightly differently.
Well, the South suffered by far most of the damage, physical damage as far as property.
It did. Yeah.
And all the battles, with save a few, and Gettysburg being the largest, occurred down south.
That is correct. And, of course, the armies bivouacked down south. And armies are most destructive not when they're fighting battles, but when they're encamped on your farm. And that's what the South experienced as well.
Yeah, I think, too, I think Craig's made an excellent excellent point that we use that term celebration so loosely as though this was a, you know, romp in the romp in the field when, again, as you said earlier, Mike, so many people were killed, and we don't even talk about the people who were maimed. We don't even talk about the people who suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome, because that wasn't even known at that particular time. But to add something to your question about North and South celebrating differently, here in Mississippi we have a sesquicentennial commission that I'm involved with. And the thing about it is, if we look at our website that we've put together, you'll notice that that could be the website of just about any other state in the United States. We present the facts, you know, what happened, what impact did this war have, and what are some of the best books available on learning the truth. So I make a big point here in Mississippi that we don't have a separate quote-unquote celebration, that we look at this war as it happened and try as hard as we can to get away from that glamorization that Craig was talking about.
Yet, Craig, as we talk about the Civil War 150 years later, Craig Simons from the U.S. Naval Academy, there was some controversy in Mississippi, Virginia, South Carolina, where the slavery was noticeably absent from proclamations about April being Confederate Heritage Month in those states.
Right. I think, again, that's a legacy of the tendency in the late 19th century, which has stretched into and throughout the 20th century, and I'm kind of surprised to re-encounter it again in the 21st, that somehow the Civil War really had little to do with slavery. And the reason for that is, I think there's a certain embarrassment on the part of many Southerners to say, well, my grandfather fought in this war, and he fought for states' rights and local government or limited powers or something constitutionally philosophical, but my great-grandfather never owned a slave, and he went out and lost an arm at the Battle of Gettysburg. Therefore, slavery was not what the Civil War was all about. And if I can understand the human instinct to want to say that, but as John mentioned, it's absolutely crucial to look facts in the face. You might be able to argue that when it began, the Civil War was not about slavery, but it was certainly caused by slavery, and slavery dominated all the political questions during the war and in the post-war era as well. And I think we need to confront that fact fairly and honestly.
Well, I think, too, you made the point about some of the proclamations and all here. I think it's well known that the governor of Mississippi is thinking of running for the presidency.
Haley Barbour, yep.
Yeah, Haley Barbour. And he, you know, he made some untoward statements. I think everybody would pretty much agree on it. But just recently he made a very forthright statement saying, well, everybody knows that the Civil War was caused by slavery. That was the primary factor. So I think if you talk to most people, I think Craig hit some key points, but I think more and more people are beginning to realize that you can talk about states' rights, you can talk about a lot of things, but when you get into it, it all comes back down to this issue of slavery.
292-8513. If you'd like to join in our discussion, we're talking about the Civil War 150 years later. Our guest, the man you just heard, John Marszalek, he's a professor emeritus at Mississippi State University, and Craig Simons, he's a professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy. Both have written several books about the Civil War and are experts in this topic. John, could the Civil War have been avoided?
Well, that's that's always an issue that that comes out quite regularly. But before I answer that, let me do a little commercial here too on your public radio, which I know you're not supposed to do. But in any case, to get back to that earlier question, one of the things that happened here in Mississippi at Mississippi State University was that the Ulysses S. Grant papers came from Illinois to Mississippi. And Grant was not the most popular figure in Mississippi, I think it can be agreed upon, but yet we have been welcomed with open arms. I mean, everybody from politicians to the average guy in the street is excited about this happening. So I think that tells us, I think, something that people are beginning to look at this whole thing in a different way and hoping that they might learn something. But getting back to your original question, could the Civil War have been avoided? You know, I think you have to say, of course, anything can be avoided. There's nothing that is predestined that it has to happen the way it happened. But having said that, as long as that issue of slavery was there, and as long as the controversy over slavery was there, it seems to me that I can't see any way, except through some divine intervention, that would prevent the war from happening over this issue, whether in 1860, 1861, or in 1870, later on, who knows. But I think sooner or later, this issue had to be confronted. And I think Lincoln understood that, maybe understood it better than anybody else.
Craig Simons from the U.S. Naval Academy. How much blame should we put on the Founding Fathers? Because this was an issue at the time that the nation was founded in 1780 and thereabouts. How much blame should we put on them for not taking this on then? Could they have taken it on then?
Blame is not a word that I would use. The Founding Fathers dealt with reality as they confronted it. The word slave does not appear in the Constitution. There are several euphemisms for slavery, but it was an issue they had to work their way around if independence and a national government were going to be achieved. And in our more enlightened time, we look back at the three-fifths clause of the Constitution, for example, and kind of wince a little bit when we look at that. But in a way, that was an enlightened view, or as enlightened as the Founding Fathers were able to be, given their time and their circumstances. It would have been more difficult, I think, 30 years later to deal with it. Blame is not the word that I would choose. I think they were realists and pragmatists and made the compromises that were necessary to ensure the creation and survival of a national union.
But you know, too, adding to what Craig just said, I mean, one of the interesting things is that the international slave trade was stated that it was going to end within 20 years, and it did. And that we kind of passed that over because slavery continued. But I think we have to understand that was a monumental statement of the Founding Fathers to make it. And it is. I mean, I think it is sad in some ways. And it's also, I think it's sad because it tells us something about the human condition. When you can have people as bright and as intellectual and as smart and whatever term you want to use, as say a Thomas Jefferson, who could not rid themselves of this belief that there were inferiors, that there were superior human beings and inferior human beings. And that was just an accepted idea, and it was not considered anything unusual. And so, I mean, that may be the saddest part, but I think Craig's right. I think it's that's the way it was at that time.
Let's go to the phones, 292-8513. If you'd like to join in our discussion, we're talking about the Civil War as we commemorate the 150th anniversary of the war between the states. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to know if there was any kind of consensus in the North about a transition from slavery to freedom if once the war was successful, prior to Lincoln's assassination, if there was any kind of coordinated effort to make a systemic approach to freedom rather than the sort of chaotic way it took place.
Just to say just a couple of things about that. That's a very difficult question because it would come down to, again, you know, defining what you mean by systematic and et cetera, et cetera. The difficulty with Reconstruction, the absolute essence of Reconstruction is how are blacks going to be, former slaves going to be included into American society as in some equal role. The problem was, again, that racism, anti-black feelings were endemic across the country in both the North and the South. And so, for example, the abolitionists just went out of business. They said, hey, we've ended slavery. There's no other problem. That'll take care of that. That'll take care of everything. We've taken care of everything. And I'm afraid that Americans just thought when slavery was ended, the inferior-superior kind of idea would simply continue.
Mm-hmm. Craig Simons from the U.S. Naval Academy, the casualties, we've touched on them briefly, but here are the numbers. On the Union side, 350,000 deaths, a majority of them from disease, but certainly a lot from battlefield wounds. On the Confederate side, specifics are hard to come by, but an estimate I've seen is 250,000 deaths, again, mainly from disease. Antietam had four times the casualties of the D-Day invasion in Normandy. Why were the casualties so high?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Civil War that keeps it in front of our eyes so much is that it took place at a time of changing technology. A lot of people are aware of the existence of the ironclad warships that fought the Monitor versus the Merrimack, for example. This is also the first real railroad war where not only armies could move by rail, but also supplies could be moved to keep them in the field longer. It's the first telegraph war. It's the first war in terms of casualties. It's the first war that involved the rifled musket and what was known as the mini ball. This is a small, conical-shaped bullet that expanded when fired to engage the rifling and therefore increased the range of shoulder arms from about 60 to 80 yards, which is what it had been before the war, to almost 10 times that, 600 to 800 yards, with accuracy, so that confrontations between forces in the field meant that you could begin shooting them down a half mile away instead of 100 yards away, and that made an enormous difference in terms of battlefield casualties. In terms of disease, which you also mentioned, of course, the germ theory of disease had not yet come to pass. I mean, it is an era of scientific discovery, but those discoveries being made even as the Civil War was being fought in France by the Pasteurs, had not yet become commonly known, so that the idea that you could operate on somebody with a saw and remove that horrible wound that the mini ball had created and then wipe the saw on your trouser leg and go to work on the next person, that, of course, contributed as well. Mm-hmm. And the idea that germs in contaminated water, and the armies were so much larger than they'd ever been before. And whenever you pack a large number of people in a small area, you get more disease.
You know, just to add again to what Craig said with the mini ball and all, I think that's an artillery be another big issue, the improvement in the firing of artillery. But the problem was that while this technological change was taking place, the tactical change in warfare wasn't moving along as quickly. We can talk about what happened later on in the war and how things changed, but this idea that massive frontal attacks, with the idea being that you have your bayonet ready and you charge and it's hand-to-hand combat and all the rest. For example, Robert E. Lee, early in the war, thought that probably the best thing to do would be to arm his soldiers with pikes, with swords, at the end of long sticks, because this hand-to-hand combat would be what would determine things. But as Craig pointed out, when you're going to come under fire a half a mile away, and you got to run a half a mile to get to the guy you're going to quote-unquote bayonet, it makes for a substantial difference in how many people are going to get killed.
Were those tactics and the failure to change tactics? We've all heard about the Union generals and Abraham Lincoln's complaints about the Union generals and their inaction. I hate to use the word blame again. Were they the reason why the war lasted 4 years? Could it have been shorter if things had been done differently?
Yeah, that's one of those what ifs that no matter what I say or Craig says, we might disagree, we're both right because we don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is an issue there of the adjustment to the kind of warfare that would be necessary. But I think you have to keep in mind too, in all fairness to those Union generals, at the beginning, the idea was, and Lincoln believed this, that there was so much unionism in the South that all you had to do is, basically keep the pressure on the South and they'll come to their senses and you won't have to go into this horrible war. That's the whole premise behind Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan. Just encircle the Confederacy and wait them out. Well, it didn't work.
Craig, your thoughts on the length of the war and did it need to be 4 years long?
Well, I think it probably probably did need to be 4 years long. First of all, I think the Confederacy was fighting with a determination to fight this out to the last individual. Lincoln did hope and believe that there was a latent unionism in the South that had just been swept up temporarily by the enthusiasm of the moment, and that if they, you know, as John said, they would come to their senses at some point. But war creates a momentum of its own, and if anything, the existence of the war and those horrible casualties only steeled the South to the longer confrontation. And you can look at that war and see how different the character of combat was in 1865 than it was in 1861. In 1861, it looked more like the Napoleonic War. Mm-hmm. In 1865, it looked more like World War One. Mm-hmm. And that's when that shift took place. Part of it is due to technology. Part of it is due to generals learning how to fight wars that involve armies of 100,000 men instead of 5,000 men.
292-8513 is our phone number. We're talking about the Civil War in observation of its 150th anniversary. When we return, we'll take a look at the role Ohio played in the war between the states, when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Are we alone in the universe? It's an age-old question. On the next Fresh Air, astrobiologist Mark Kaufman says we may be closer than ever to finding out if life exists on other planets. His new book is First Contact: Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins. Ohio Governor Kasich plans to privatize five of Ohio prisons by selling the land and facilities to private corrections operators. A discussion with Ohio Department of Corrections Director Gary Moore on All Sides at 11 o'clock here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Juan and John April 7th through the 10th. Solo performer Roger Guenver Smith brings to life the story of two baseball legends' violent encounter at home plate in 1965. More at wexarts.org.
Showers and thunderstorms throughout the day today, especially this afternoon, a high of 69 degrees. Currently a wind advisory in effect with wind gusts of up to 55 miles per hour. More showers and thunderstorms tonight and a low of 37. And then some sunshine tomorrow, a high of 49. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann Fisher today. Our guests are John Marzalek. He is a professor emeritus of history at Mississippi State University and author of the book Sherman, A Soldier's Passion for Order. And Craig Simons, professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy and author of the book, the latest book, The New York Times Complete Civil War, 1861 to 1865. 292-8513 is our number if you'd like to join in our discussion as we observe the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And Norman, you're on the air.
Thank you. I used to be an American history teacher, and over the course of teaching and reading about the Civil War, I came to believe that this whole slavery issue was way overblown and that the reasons for the war between the states was more economic. The only product the United States had was cotton, which went from the South to England, and manufactured goods that were made in the North could not be sold in Europe because they had their own manufactured goods. The Southern states were forced to buy it from the North because the North passed tariffs that were so high that the South decided, hey, we can buy our stuff cheaper from Europe. We don't need you. They seceded. The North said, we cannot afford to lose you. There was no support for the war. You had the Copperhead Party. You had draft riots. And one last thing, I was watching American Experience, and they said something about on the story about Abraham Lincoln that he was under serious pressure from Wall Street financiers who had loaned all the money to the Southern planters over all those years, and they feared that they would not get repaid.
All right, let's get some. Craig, let's take those.
Yeah, let me take that on. That's That's superficially correct in terms of the economic differences between the North and South. There's no doubt the tariff was a big issue. It had become an issue early in the Republic in the first decade of the 19th century and remained a big issue through the nullification crisis of the 1830s, and was certainly a part of the national conversation when the Civil War emerged in 1860-61. But it was not the cause of the war. It didn't have the emotional impact that the future of slavery did. And let me make a distinction here that's absolutely essential to understanding what's going on in the Civil War. It's not that the North wants to abolish slavery and the South wants to keep slavery. Virtually everyone agreed that slavery in the states where it existed could remain there. The question was, what would be the future of slavery in the Western territories? The South believed, probably correctly, that if slavery as a labor system did not expand into the Western states, it would die of its own dead weight. When the number of slaves available to labor outstripped the available land, their value would decline, it would cost more to sustain them than they could produce in terms of labor, and it would undermine the entire system. So Southerners believed slavery had to expand. Northerners, particularly those Northerners represented by Abraham Lincoln, believed that slavery would also die out in a generation or two if you kept it confined. And we wanted to keep that Western land, we Northerners wanted to keep that Western land available for white settlement. So preventing slavery from going into the Western territory was the entire platform on which Lincoln ran. So the question that brought the nation to this horrible pass was, should slavery be allowed to extend and expand into the Western territories? The South said it must, the North said it cannot, and that's why they went to war.
292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion as we look back on the Civil War 150 years later. John Marszalek from the University of Mississippi State University.
Yes.
Where did Ohio stand prior to the war? I mean, it's a northern state, but it's, you know, it borders the South, it borders Kentucky.
Right. Let me just add to what Craig said, too, that I think one of the major phenomenon, I think if you look at those resolutions, those secession resolutions, what they all talk about is slavery. For example, tariff is not even mentioned in the South Carolina resolution. And when commissioners were sent from those first states to secede to try to convince places like Virginia and North Carolina and others to join the effort, all they talked about was slavery. So it's very difficult to make the argument, I think, that economics were more important, unless you argue that it's the economics of slavery. Then I would agree with that.
But you still hear those arguments. But let's get back to Ohio. Was Ohio firmly in the camp of the North, or was it split?
Well, Ohio is an interesting place, as was the Midwest. I mean, and Ohioans know this better than I do. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, so I'm a little further away from Ohio, but closer than I am now. But the thing about it was Ohio had southern Ohio and northern Ohio, and they were settled from different directions, and they had a different approach and attitude toward this whole question of slavery and the animosity between the sections. If you look at what happened during the war, you notice, for example, that Ohio produces a lot of regiments for the Union cause. It produces generals like Grant and Sherman and many others, and a lot of agricultural products, a lot of supplies come from Ohio. But Ohio is also, in many ways, the center of opposition to the war. If you think of, for example, Clement Van Landingham and the role that he played, the so-called Copperhead. So Ohio is a split situation. I know Sherman used to talk about his hometown of Lancaster being split and not exactly completely in support of the Union. So I would argue that Ohio plays a major role in preserving the Union, but it's like any state, I think it goes both ways.
Mike, if I can, when you asked John that question, I pulled out my copy of Dyer's Compendium of Statistics on the War.
And okay, good.
So your listeners may be interested that Ohio produced more Union soldiers than any other state, save two, and that is New York. I guess you'd expect it to have the most.
Mm-hmm.
New York had 409 citizens of the state of New York who went off to the war. Pennsylvania was second at 315,000, and Ohio was third at 304,814 Ohioans who went to war to fight for the Union. And I will just add, given my institutional affiliation, 3,274 sailors as well.
Did any Ohioans fight for the South that we know of?
I'm sure they did. Those numbers do not appear here. I will make one comment about that. There's a lot of discussion about whether this should be called the Civil War or the War Between the States or something else. I always prefer the term Civil War because it's important to remember that there were citizens from nearly every state who fought on both sides.
Right.
There were white regiments in the Union Army from every Confederate state except South Carolina. So there were probably some Ohioans who fought for the South, but they did not do so in Ohio units, which is interesting. They would have to have joined a Kentucky unit, for example.
John Marzalek from Mississippi State University, you've written the book Sherman, A Soldier's Passion for Order, and the symposium in Lancaster, Sherman's hometown, April 15th through 17th, looks at the last few weeks of the Civil War and the two main players, you know, General Sherman and also Confederate General Joseph E. Johnston, who surrendered to General Sherman. Why were those two men important in the final weeks of the war, and how will they, why are they intertwined?
Well, first of all, I'll say that anybody really interested in your audience, really interested, has got to come to Lancaster to hear Craig and me speak, because we will certainly answer every possible question at that particular time. But it's going to be a great event. Laura Bullock from the Sherman House has done a great job in organizing all of this. But just briefly, I think the irony is, in many ways, that Sherman and Johnston are in opposition during the Atlanta campaign, which brings the Union Army to Atlanta, and from Atlanta it goes to Savannah and then up through the Carolinas. And the irony is, when the war is coming to an end, who's again opposing Sherman but Joe Johnston? So they do play a major role. And then, of course, it's the famous meeting between Johnston and Sherman when they try to figure out a way to end the war, and Sherman really goes too far and tries to do some things that a military commander shouldn't do. But now I think they're both very, very essential, particularly at the end of the war.
Johnston, when learning of Lincoln's assassination, said the South has lost its best friend, Craig Simons from the Naval Academy. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think that it was generally recognized that Lincoln was not someone who was going to prostrate the South deliberately in any case. I mean, his name was vilified throughout the war, and he was called the original guerrilla and all that, whatever term you could think of to be pejorative to him. But there still was a general recognition that he was not the kind of person who would put his heel on the neck of the South, and it was feared that those abolitionists before the war, who became what were known as radicals during the war, might be inclined to do that. Joe Johnston was horrified, too, that once having killed the American president just at the end of the war like that, that there would be a feeling, an emotion of revenge that would come into play against the South. And among certain people, I think that was probably the case.
We're looking back at the 150th anniversary, looking back on the Civil War here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann. Just a couple of minutes left. John Marzalek from Mississippi, describe the differences between Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis and how they led their two sides.
I think one of the, maybe, you know, you could say a lot of different things. And in fact, a very famous historian named David Potter many years ago maybe gave the ultimate insult to Jeff Davis when he said that if the two sides had switched presidents and Lincoln had been president of the Confederacy would have won the Civil War. That's, I think, a little bit too far. But I think it is fair to note the difference between the two men. Lincoln is one of the greatest politicians that the United States has ever had. And I know that's a dirty word today, but politician is an honorable profession. But I think the big difference, and just in one word, I think would be humility. Lincoln had a tremendous amount of humility in the way he ran the war. Jefferson Davis was overwhelmed with this pride that just couldn't be broken. And that's a simplistic answer, but quick answer.
Craig Simons from the Naval Academy, have the wounds of the Civil War really healed? When you look at our politics today, I mean, we hear it over and over again. There are red states and there are blue states. But when you look at that map, you really could easily, just as easily say gray states in blue states.
I mean, you could. I found it interesting during the 2004 presidential election that the Democratic candidate carried every state save one that had been in the Union during the Civil War, and the Republican candidate carried every state entirely that had fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War. Now, that's not necessarily a cause and effect, but I think there is a legacy, a shadow, if you would, of the cultural differences between the two sides that remains, and the whole sense that government should have greater authority or government should have limited authority was certainly part of the argument in the 1860s, and it's part of the argument in politics today. So, yes, there's a shadow, I think, of that that remains in our society still.
John Marzalek from Mississippi, is there any way, do you ever see that lessening? It seems to us have intensified.
Yeah, I think I do. I think as I grew up in Buffalo, New York, went to graduate school in Indiana at Notre Dame, whose women happened to have won the big basketball game yesterday, but I won't mention that. But I think the point I'm making is I now live in Mississippi and have lived here since 1973, and my wife and I often talk about this. We do see a difference. We see people's attitude changing. Has Mississippi suddenly become a hotbed of liberalism? No, I wouldn't think so. Do we have problems? Yes, we do. But by the same token, when it comes to this racial issue, can really see differences in the way that whites and blacks deal with each other. For example, I think Mississippi State University still has the largest percentage of black students of any land-grant school in the country. So I think things are changing. But and I think the fact that the grant papers are here and the reception we received indicates that too.
Craig Simons, just about a minute left. Far-fetched as it might be, is there any chance this country could ever see another Civil War?
No, I'll just be clear on that. Absolutely. We become the United States of America is a single noun now. We don't say the United States are a great country. We say the United States is a great country. And I think that's permanent. I think that's a legacy of the war. I think we are a single nation and we'll argue with each other. But by golly, when an outsider threatens us, we will band together and stand back to back. So I just cannot imagine a circumstance in which we confront another civil war.
John, do you agree?
Yeah, I do too. I think, for example, one other major example would be a reason I think for that would be the difference in the technology. Again, imagine trying to secede from the Union and to fight the United States Army, the United States Navy, the United States Air Force. It would be.
And don't leave out the Marine Corps there, John.
Oh, the Marine Corps too. That's right. Exactly. And I throw in the Navy simply because it's there. You know. But
all right. On that note, a little dig at Craig Simon, Professor Emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy, and also John Marzalek, History Professor Emeritus from the Mississippi State University. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see them in Lancaster April 15th through the 17th.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher with me, guest host Mike Thompson on 89.7 NPR News and streaming online at WOSU.org.